Good morning. It is 9:08 as we welcome you into Friday, a forensic Friday, by the way, the fifth day of September. We're brought to you by Landscaper's Corner at 1305 Old Frankfort Pike. Landscaper's Corner has Triple Crown grass seed, the best seed for our area. It's available in 5, 25, and 50-pound bags, 225-9433. Our question of the day is brought to you by United Structural Systems, a professional foundation repair and waterproofing company in business for over 20 years. iFixFoundations.com, 859-254-7700. Are children today so overprotected that they may have problems coping with life as adults? That's our question. You tell us at WVLKAM.com. Tune in for the results with Cruiser and Crew between noon and 3. Our question yesterday, Kentucky State University kicking out more than 600 students because of overdue bills. Should a state school do that? We were kind of overwhelmed with the response. 94% said yep. 6% said no. Well, Forensic Friday, Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us. Morning, Ray.
Good morning, Jack.
Glad to have you back. You were on assignment last week. Can you say what you were doing?
No, it was pretty secret stuff.
Okay. All right. Well, then we won't ask.
Okay.
This morning we've got obviously a subject and some guests, but I want to deal with real quickly with an email that was sent by Laura over in Lawrenceburg, because this doesn't have anything to do with what we're going to talk about today. She said, I was wondering if you could ask Ray to make a quick pass at the subject of college rape. They would be the best ones to tell, they being your office, to tell exactly what a rape victim should do. I'm thinking go straight to the real police protection and to the hospital to do a rape kit for evidence. The colleges complicate the procedure when their private guards and downplay the problem with their private guards and downplay the problem. How best to get serious law enforcement for a college kid? What would prosecutors tell their daughters and granddaughters to do?
Well, that's a very timely subject, Jack, because Title IX is a federal law that involves all men and women are to be treated the same kind of thing, and under that, the universities, rapes on university campuses is a big deal. And it's happening.
And it's getting worse, I think, isn't it? Or not?
We don't know.
Don't know.
You see, she's right. They don't do a lot, haven't done a lot of reporting in the past, and that's what's been kind of outrageous. So we've spent, I guess, a couple of days last week working with the University of Kentucky, and we'll ultimately end up working with Transylvania. And the school system, the Fayette County Public Schools and any other school, because this Title IX applies to all of that. The question is what should occur, and that's what we're trying to do, because the universities and the schools have an obligation to deal with people who are allegations of rape, and they do things administratively. And in the process, they can call, assume that somebody accused you of rape. They can call, university can call you in and have a kind of a hearing very quickly, and to determine whether or not it's a civil preponderance of the evidence as opposed to beyond a reasonable doubt. By the preponderance of the evidence, is there sufficient evidence to believe you did, in fact, commit a sexual assault? Mm. And if so, they can throw you out of school. Now, that sort of complicates a criminal investigation, because they would bring this young person in. They don't advise them of their Miranda rights. They compel them to make some sort of a statement, and as a result, we can't use that statement. You see,
it's gosh, just, yeah, that's bad.
So what we want to do is have 24 hours for the police department to conduct an investigation, so that we can before the school begins their process. Now, Mary Houlihan is one of our superstar guests today, and she's a director of our victim services. And Mary, what's the what's your advice to what should a young person do?
Well, I think the person writing this email actually already hit upon some of the important points. And what I would do if I was in their position would be to go to a hospital and request what is called a SANE exam. That examination allows for the collection of evidence but does not compel the victim to necessarily have to move forward with the criminal investigation.
SANE?
SANE, S-A-N-E.
Good.
Sexual assault nurse examination.
Good. And that's a very victim-driven sort of step to take, because it allows them, while they're in the trauma, to have attention to the medical issues they might be facing because of the assault, but gives them time to decide where they want to go with that information. And the issue, what we're dealing with the current interest by the universities to increase their reporting, we want to make sure that reporting means importing to giving them the opportunity to report to law enforcement and prioritizing that investigation, because what Ray's talking about is notifying a perpetrator before an investigation has initiated. That perpetrator then has all the information on what's being alleged, and the police can lose their footing on what they can get the person to admit to, or the collection of the appropriate evidence and all of that. So I would say to report to a hospital and request a SANE exam. Police will then be notified, and the victim still will have the choices whether they want to proceed criminally.
Let me add something. If the university is not involved in cases in which that occur off university property, or if they're not all students. And so what happens then, Jack, is in the Good Samaritan emergency room, and in the UK Med Center emergency room, there are UK police are there. And if a young woman comes in and alleges that she's been sexually assaulted, then the UK police are aware of it. The question then becomes, does UK have jurisdiction? Because the University of Kentucky police don't have jurisdiction all over town, just within the university and the contiguous streets. So if jurisdiction is not with the university, they our agreement, we hope, will be that they will immediately notify the Lexington Police Department, and then within a very short period of time, they can conduct the appropriate investigation.
Well, maybe we ought to do a show on this. Sounds like it's a timely topic.
All right.
We have guests this morning, as you mentioned. Tell us who you brought with you today.
Well, Sergeant Ron Keaton is the supervisor of the Collision Reconstruction Unit with the Lexington Division of Police. As we've just introduced, Mary Houlihan, who is in charge of the victim services in our office, and one of our prosecutors is Katie Webster. And Katie was, in our office, was responsible for a vehicular case. It was a vehicular assault case. But Ron's operation are the people that investigated it, and I'd like to start with Ron, if I can.
Good morning, Ron.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Ron, why don't you talk a little bit about what does it take? What is the Collision Reconstruction Unit? What kind of training do you have to become a member of that unit, and what is it that you all do?
The Collision Reconstruction Unit is a section within the Traffic Division of the Police Department. We investigate serious physical injury, fatal collisions, or collisions where felony charges may arise out of the collision. To be certified as a reconstructionist, the officers have to go through an interview process, get selected. You have to have a minimum of 3 years on the department, and then we send them to a six-week, 240-hour basic collision reconstruction unit training, where they get the basics of reconstructing a collision. And then there are several specialized schools involving pedestrian collisions, commercial motor vehicle collisions, motorcycle collisions, and other things like
that. Is that at Eastern?
There's different places that have it.
Oh, okay.
Right now, currently, we've been with the Kentucky State Police doing joint training with them, and that's kind of how we've been getting our training lately, because budget crunches. Normally, people go to IPTM, the Institute of Police Technology and Management in Florida, but we've been able to work with the Kentucky State Police recently to do that training here.
Pedestrian collisions are in the news this week, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
And there was a woman who was struck, a pedestrian who was struck and killed. And how do you determine whether or not, in those kind of situations, a criminal charges? And how do you determine whether or not, in those kind of situations, a criminal charge is brought, or is it a tragic accident?
Basically, we look at take the circumstances surrounding the collision, look at the factors that were involved in the collision, both on the part of, in the case of a pedestrian collision, the part of the pedestrian and the motorist. If we have a pedestrian who's not crossing at a crosswalk, or maybe they're in a crosswalk crossing against a green light and they get struck by a car, that's not necessarily going to warrant a criminal charge against the person driving the car. We look at impairment issues on the part of both parties. Sometimes we have people who are impaired as pedestrians that walk out into the street and get struck by cars, so we're not going to... That's not going to fall. The responsibility is not going to fall on the driver.
So it's obviously done on an individual case basis.
Yes, every case.
All right, we're going to take a break. If you guys have questions, a very interesting subject. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-CM.com. Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Katie Webster with us. Victims Advocate Mary Houlihan. Sergeant Ron Keaton. Of course, Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson. This is a case that involved six vehicle collision. It occurred in March of 2013, kind of in the middle of the night, 3:39 in the morning to be exact, and two people were injured. Ray, probably ought to just get on with the case right now since we're halfway through the show.
Ron, tell us a little bit. So tell us about how you were notified of this, and tell us what happened.
All right, the police department actually received a call of a drunk driver in this case, and the officers were trying to locate that vehicle. In doing so, they drove up on the collision before they could actually locate this drunk driver. Basically, the call was this guy had left the Shell station on Richmond Road next to the Mercedes dealership, heading outbound Richmond Road. The officers went outbound Richmond Road trying to locate him. They got outside of Man of War, almost to Jacobson Park, around Shoreside Drive. And that's when they rolled up on this collision, and it was involving the vehicle that matched the description of the drunk driver. At some point, he had gone outbound Richmond Road and got turned around and back on the wrong side of the road and was coming inbound in the outbound lanes, at which point he sideswiped two passenger cars, sideswiped a couple tractor trailers, and then hit another vehicle head-on and injured the two people in that vehicle. It was a Chevy Equinox.
Okay, so that was the last one that it hit head-on, right?
Yes.
And that Ashley Randecker and Tyler Miller Schoen were the people in that last vehicle.
Yes.
Okay, so what sort of injuries did they suffer?
They suffered several incapacitating injuries. They were transported to the hospital. They had broken ankles, broken ribs, I think, several injuries to their internal organs from the impact of the collision.
Was the defendant hurt? No.
The defendant was transported to the hospital. I think he did have some injuries, facial injuries and head injuries. He was not seatbelted in, and his truck actually came apart, and when we towed that vehicle in, it had to be towed in five different separate pieces because it came apart during the collision.
So were any of the truck drivers or any of the other sideswipe cars?
None of the other cars. Nobody was injured in the other cars. None of the tractor-trailer drivers were injured. It was basically Mr. Miller Schoen and Ms. Randecker, and then the suspect were all injured and transported to the hospital.
So your reconstruction unit is called in when? Immediately?
Once the patrol officers get on scene, they assess the situation. They determine, is this a fatal collision? Is it serious physical injury that could result in a felony charge? And they notify a patrol supervisor who then comes to the scene, and then they make the determination to call our unit to the scene.
And if you are called to the scene, you have to block traffic?
Yes. Yes, we come to the scene. We'll shut down the roadway for as long as it takes us to finish our investigation.
How long
at the scene.
How long did you have to do it?
This morning on this collision, we were out there. We got called out there probably about, by the time we got out there, it was about 4:30 in the morning, and it was later in the afternoon that day by the time we got finished with this investigation.
So you're blocking a major incoming route to Lexington for a number of hours.
Yes, yes, we had it closed down probably for about 8 to 9 hours, and we actually had to reroute traffic that day, which was a big
deal.
Huge deal.
Interesting.
Now, let's talk a little bit about. So those are the basics of this, Katie, and so that you are assigned this case as it comes into our office. Now, tell us what you as a prosecutor do.
Well, as a prosecutor, the first thing I did was to look at the investigation that CRU had
done. Get a little bit closer to that mic. There we go.
The defendant in this case was a guy named Joshua Ivey, and he was charged with initially one count of assault first for the injuries to Ashley Randecker, because at the time of the incident, we weren't exactly sure what the injuries were to Tyler Miller Schoen, the second victim in the case. As we began preparing for the case, we realized that he had also sustained very serious injuries. He had major medical surgery and lost part of his internal organs as a result of this collision. So we prepared for the case, we worked with the officers, and we went to grand jury, and he was indicted for two counts of assault first degree as it related to both Ashley Randecker and Tyler Miller Schoen.
We're going to take a break, and we'll get more into that and what all that legalese means here in just a moment. And if you have a question, 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, email jackpatty@wblkam.com. This is Jim. Good morning, Jim.
Yes, sir. I'd just like to figure out a way to speed up the process of this crime scenes on the highway and wherever they happen. Do you all have a way of bringing in satellites to fly over, so to speak, and take pictures of the area, or use the police helicopter to take pictures?
Question directed to
you. Well, yeah, I guess.
Let me begin that. The pictures are just a small part of the investigation, because they're looking for marks on the roadway that are made by tires and metal parts of the car and or vehicle and that sort of thing. And it's the photographs are not the major issue here. It's so, Ron, what do you look for when you get on these crime scenes?
When we get to these scenes, like Mr. Larson said, we have a lot of roadway evidence we look for, tire marks, gouge marks. The tire marks can help us establish speeds if we think speed is a factor. The gouge marks help us to establish where the collision may have occurred on the roadway, if there was an issue with another car crossing over into oncoming lane of traffic. So there's a lot of things for us to look for, and because the roadway, everybody travels up and down the roadway, sometimes it's hard to discern. We have to be sure what is there from that collision and what is not a part of that collision. And in this case, we had two tractor trailers and four passenger cars. So you've got a lot of roadway evidence, a lot of tire marks, a lot of things that we have to look through to be sure of that we use. And we do have technological advances that help us speed up that process, such as a total station. We've got a 3D scanner now that helps us scan the scenes, as opposed to the old days when we had a roadway closed down, we had to pull out tape measures and measure everything. Now those things help us speed up that process. So we do have different technological advances that we use to try to speed that up. But sometimes, we want to be sure that we have the evidence we have on the roadway is what we're looking at, is what we have, because that's going to be what we use in court when we place charges on someone, and we don't want to be wrong on that.
Well, and the police are fully aware of the inconvenience to everybody else, but at that point they may make the decision is that we need to investigate this thing. If they think it's a crime, they need to investigate it, and we're all sorry about it. I've sat in traffic for a couple of hours, and Jack, as we all know, thank goodness we got these little telephones that mm-hmm. we can entertain ourselves with these days. I want to get to you said, Ron, that there was a report that this defendant, Joshua Ivey, left the Shell station and was perceived to be under the influence.
Yes.
Right. Now, how do we go about proving somebody is under the influence from an evidentiary standpoint?
In our cases, a lot of times, such as in this case, our defendants or our suspects are injured and they get transported to the hospital. So we can't do like a normal routine DUI where we take them and give them a breath test. And so we have to get their blood work. We go to the hospital, send an officer to the hospital, and we draw blood from those suspects and send it off to a private lab.
Is that something that the suspect has to give their permission to take place?
Good question. Now, because that's where we're going.
Yeah.
There are two ways to get that. One is if you ask the person for consent to draw mm-hmm. their blood. And the other way is to get a court order. And in this case, that was a problem in the case.
He didn't want to give it.
No. You tell us what the issue is, Katie.
Well, the issue that came about is that when the defendant was taken to the hospital, he had pretty severe injuries as a result of the collision that he caused. He was unable to sign a form that said he consented to his blood being drawn. And the officer who spoke with him thought that the defendant was consenting and saying yes, but his jaw was broken. So the defendant asked for a hearing on this issue and stated that he did not consent to having his blood drawn.
So was that not allowed as evidence?
Correct.
It was suppressed. The motion to suppress the evidence because they claimed that he didn't give consent.
Okay.
And so what was his blood alcohol, Ron?
The blood alcohol came back at a .204.
So he was twice the legal.
So he was slammed.
Yeah.
So to speak. And so the point is we lost that, and that as a result that played a role in how the case was ultimately played out. Now, that one of the things that's an issue in these things is we talk to the families of the injured people, and sometimes they're pretty angry about why did the police screw that up,
right?
Kind of thing is what they say, and you have to spend time talking with them. And Ron and Mary and Katie and I spent a long time talking to the Randeckers, and so Mary, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, these young people were actually traveling through Kentucky on their way to a wedding when this occurred, so they are not from here. And that adds a whole other complication to assisting them as crime victims, because basically for a year we're talking on the phone. We've never even met in person. So they're needing to very much trust me as their advocate, but really all I'm doing is relaying this kind of bad news. How do you tell somebody that it's going to be difficult to prosecute a DUI when those blood results are thrown out?
Yeah.
And how is that ever going to sound fair to somebody whose children were injured severely and whose lives will never be the same? Mm-hmm. And you have to say, we have to plead this because we have lost the proof that this person was actually driving under the influence, even though his behavior was so completely egregious. But they did come for the guilty plea, and meeting in person, I believe, really changed a lot for both of us. I mean, you know, I told them I pictured somebody different until we finally met in person. But just hearing directly, seeing the people that have worked very hard on this case, seeing that we are also frustrated completely by the limitations the court imposes on these cases, makes them all kind of realize differently that we're on the same team and trying under very, very difficult circumstances.
Jim, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. You're on the air.
I'm, my question was for Ray or Katie. My understanding, there's also a third way to get a chemical result from a defendant. In the case of a vehicular homicide or vehicular assault, if the defendant is treated, if is injured, and they take his blood for treatment purposes, which my understanding is they often do to make sure there's no contraindication with any anesthesia or something like that, doesn't the grand jury have the ability to subpoena that result even without violating HIPAA with their private medical records?
That's right. The issue that we run into with those sorts of with doing that, if we don't get the evidence right away, then the chain of custody that we have to prove in criminal case has to be absolutely precise.
What does that mean, chain of custody?
Well, for example, if I drew your blood, then I would have to hand it, I'd have to, in order for it to be admitted, mm-hmm. I have to testify. I drew the blood. I gave it to Katie, who transported it to the lab, who picked it up at the lab, and who gave it to the analyst, and who was the analyst, and then go right back down.
I see.
And if we don't, if that doesn't occur immediately, then you don't, because they don't hand to hand it. It's a they typically will put it in a. Something to be transported ultimately to the lab. So yeah, you're right. But we were operating with the idea that this guy gave consent, and then by the time we ran into the it was suppressed. It's very difficult to go back and recreate a chain of custody in a hospital for treatment purposes. But you make a good point, and we have done that in the past, but you have to do it almost immediately.
You an attorney, Jim?
I am.
Yeah.
And my second question is, does Lexington Metro have a policy, a uniform policy in the case of injury or death, to go ahead and instead of having that possibility that the consent is not going to be given, right, go ahead and trying to obtain search warrant for the defendant's blood.
Okay, we're losing you. Did you get that?
Yeah, he wants to know if we just basically don't do consent, just go ahead and get a court order.
I see. What's the policy on that?
We try to go ahead and get the court order. Of course, a court order or a search warrant has got to be based on probable cause. And if we don't have any probable cause to do that, a lot of times we can't get a court order to do that.
Jim,
we do try to do that.
Okay. Good call, Jim. Thanks. We have to take a break. 253. 9 minutes away from 10 o'clock, News Talk 590 WVLK. This is really an interesting program. A lot of times we get into the technicalities that are involved in being a prosecutor, and it almost seems like a lot of things are sort of put up that kind of make it difficult for you to do your job. Of course, we have to protect the rights of the defendants in these cases.
Yeah, but, you know, to say that it was a technicality. Well, it is a technicality, but the technicalities are what we have to do.
Right.
And you don't want people prosecuted on, you know, sort of half prepared cases.
Right.
And
we got about 4 minutes to wrap this one.
That was a legitimate ruling by the court.
Yeah.
And so we just didn't like it.
Sure.
Okay, Katie, so let's talk about how this case was resolved.
Well, it was set for trial in July, and we were prepared to go to trial. We knew it was going to be pretty intense. We had a lot of witnesses and a lot of victims in this case. We wound up through a lot of discussions with the defendant's attorney. He pled guilty to 2 counts of assault second degree, 6 years for each victim, for Ashley and for Tyler.
Now, we also spent a lot of time talking to the family of the victims in this case. Matter of fact, the two parents came over from Illinois to talk to us, the Rendeckers.
Were these people who were injured young?
Hell yeah.
They were young, and they were from out of state, and their GPS basically took them off the road to get gas and straight through downtown out the other side, as opposed to what might have made the most sense, but not knowing the area, which is just another added insult to this case, that if the GPS hadn't told them that, then maybe that this could have all been avoided.
Really?
But again, this man and his actions were out to hurt someone that night, because there was just so much going wrong with the driving that he was exhibiting in our city.
So tell us about talking with the family.
So the family may well be listening now. They've been as involved as they can be. They drove 8 hours here just to be present for the sentencing, which is, you know, a lot of worry for me. I found myself texting with them because I was worried about when they would get here, and the idea that you're going on all the roadways that your kids drove on. But the parents were the ones that I mainly talked to, because these were young people that were, you know, not only dealing with such significant injuries to get over, but this court experience is hard enough for anybody to understand. But when you're kind of thrown into the whole system as a crime victim, innocent until proven guilty sounds great until you're a crime victim.
No kidding.
And once
That's
you're
right.
a crime victim, you realize it's the bad guy that has all the rights, and that the victims have very, very few. And so the families were incredibly understanding of bad news after bad news. And, you know, really my goal is to focus them on how to get through this, and not connecting the outcome of the criminal justice system to anything about where they take it from here, where they go from here. And they're, you know, very, very reasonable, very upset at all the right things that we're also upset at, too. Mm-hmm. But we just don't get to ever pretend that we know what it's like walking in their shoes. We just try and support them through the process.
This is, and you know, I'll tell you this: the mother of Ashley is my kind of woman. I mean, she's
tough.
She is. I'm trying.
Victims get to write a victim impact statement to the judge at sentencing. This was the most colorful one any of us have read or seen. And one of the things that I did after
she taught me some new words.
Did she?
Yeah.
One of the things I did after seeing it was I wanted to make sure that Ray approved it before I sent it to the judge, in regard to, are we making the judge mad? Should I give them better advice? But the only time victims get to say exactly what they think to the judge is through this statement. And so our determination was to leave it exactly
as
she said it. And she very rationally behaved well in court. And the judge herself said, you know, if it was my daughter, I might have said worse.
Here's an email from a listener. Sherry is her name. And I just thought this was a nice way to end the program this morning. Says, if any of us, and she says, thanks to your guests. She says, if any of us were victims in these situations, we would be so thankful for the detail and time it takes to get all the evidence possible to make a case. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
That is nice to hear.
Update from ABC Next. If you're listening to WBC.